Just to clear up the historical piece from yesterday, otherwise I want to talk about what we've just done. The court jester in Britain ends at the at the time of the Civil War. So it's Charles I had a court jester, but of course with Charles I is executed and all that stuff of course is swept away. See a similar thing happening later, happening a bit later in France. Charles II, when in the Restoration, did away with the office of the court jester. Now he was a notorious. It's kind of interesting that was the case because Charles II was a notoriously autocratic king who couldn't brook any opposition to his will. So there is no way he would have wanted to. A jester making fun of him and making fun of his ideas, but in Eastern Europe, in Russia, for example, it continues until the end of the Romanov dynasty, and in Eastern Europe, in the various monarchies in Eastern Europe, that it continues at least down into the 18th century. So it's a much more longer lived thing there. And there's no equivalent in Islamic society or in most other non-Christian societies. It really feels like it comes out of the, as far as I've been able to work out, comes out really of the idea of Christ as the holy fool. And this very strong tradition you had coming out of Byzantium, of the holy fools of Byzantium. And this is why, of course, you get it. Early Christian church, the idea of the feast of fools, and so that image then becomes, if you like, endemic within Western and Eastern Christian culture. And as we saw yesterday, then becomes more secularized. You end up with the image of the clown. In Venice, you have it enshrined in the carnival, in the image in the Piero. And of course, the other thing, and of course, in the Renaissance renewal, which is when we find the tarot being created, the fool becomes one of the principal trumps. So that's a bit of the history, really.
Can you just say a couple of things? Like something about the holy fool, Christ is a holy fool.
Yes. Well, this is the idea that Christ reverses the normal order of the world. Right, so this whole thinking you have in Christian tradition that goes right back to the beginning, that goes right back to the Egyptian desert, where the Christianity inverts the natural order of things. So if you think that Christianity arises out of the Roman Empire, and it's in a way a completely subversive movement. Where poverty and absence of apparent material power is considered to be the highest value. So you get that image of Christ, easier for a camel to pass through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter into heaven. And these injunctions of go, give all you have to the poor, if you would enter the kingdom. So it is this kind of divine foolishness, sort of in the side that brings you into the kind of the deeper, this powerful, the spiritual place. So it is this literal inversion. So Christ is seen as the holy fool who enters into situations saying the foolish thing that turns the world upside down. And what you see really with the one of the very confusing things for the Roman Empire in particular was these people who just gave all their stuff away. This is such a bizarre to an educated Roman. This is like ridiculous. Why on earth would you ever do that? And so the, and why on earth would you want a religion that says this? You know, because the pagan religions, really, in the Roman Empire, are very much about, you know, do good by the gods, and the gods do good for you, you know, and sort of, you all kind of prosper together. You know, the idea that you would give everything away, to a Roman, would have been completely anathema. So it is that sense where Christianity is this kind of radical kind of religion that says, kind of, do the foolish thing. And periodically what you have, and you have these prophetic, really you find it in Judaism as well, these prophetic figures that come out of the desert, that challenge power, that speak truth to power, that turn the world upside down. So you then get this tradition in Eastern Roman Empire of the holy fools who will challenge the will of the emperor, and are allowed to because they're given this kind of sort of slightly outside the world sacred idea. And the idea of it, the deeper idea of it in a certain sense, is this kind of sense of randomness, this sense of something that breaks up the existing order, that operates from a different dimension, that operates from a deeper dimension, that shows us that the world is different, the universe is different from the way we think it is. So if you like, the deepest message of the Holy Fool is that you don't have to hoard your goods in order to feel safe. This is an universe in which you are profoundly loved, profoundly accompanied, profoundly safe. Give it all away, you'll be fine. Right? So it challenges that instinctive energy in us to gather our own stuff to us and protect that, because that's all we have. And this is the reversal, because it says true poverty is total wealth. Wealth is poverty, because you're gathering together and you never have enough, so you're always feeding that black hole at the heart of you, which is convinced of your own poverty. So that reversal says, no, give it all away, you'll be fine. Oh yeah, most of it, absolutely. Yeah, completely. Trusting entire camel. No, it's more radical than that. Much more radical. It says, no, don't, it says, no, get it all away. That's the foolishness at the heart of it. You know, don't tie your camel up. You know, tying your camel would be an act of poverty. You know, in that way of understanding it. And it's because it's operating at a deeper level, it's speaking a deeper level of truth. You know, at an earlier part of the journey, tying up your camel is necessary, but it's saying when you come to this place, then you give it all away. You invert everything. Now in the meditation we've just done, we've done a journey really right up through the tree, right up through the whole journey that we've undertaken in these last 3 years. And where we come to in the end is this cathedral of light that is actually more dense, more substantial than matter itself. And again, this is that act of reversal. So when we come into the Cathedral of Light, when we come into the living presence of the Fool, its substance, its substantiality, its density means that we descend with it, because it's heavier than everything else. It looks like it's lighter than everything else because it's pure light, but light is heavier than everything else. Everything ultimately is formed of light. Light is the substance of the universe. So we return with the Fool, just here, just now, and with us are the angels and archangels, all the company of heaven. Okay. And you know, one of the way, I mean, so what we did was to use the tarot cards in a slightly more or less related to where we've been looking at the tree, but not quite. But there are in the kind of the journey and how the journey presented itself to me. We began really with the 32nd path. We're in the cave. We have this image of the hermaphrodite, who is the opener, who brings us into the experience of the table and the dancing figures and the sense of the dance. And then we're confronted by the angelic figure of temperance, who is like the living veil of water, who then takes us to the blasted tower, and then we find ourselves heading towards Tiferet. And some of the tarot images of Tiferet accompany us and meeting us. And then where I flip it a bit, instead of meeting the strength card, we meet the justice card in the place of balance. And she introduces us to the path of the High Priestess, which brings us to the gateway of the Empress, which then brings us into the deep dynamics of the magician and the fool and the supernal triangle that is the highest and the deepest place.
It's really lovely to push it on the board in that way.
It doesn't quite work to do that because I didn't use the so it's actually, well, what I've did there was to use the trumps very loosely. Because actually the whole point about the tarot and the tree, particularly the trumps and the paths, is they you can swap them over. For example, Marcus's teacher Bill used a completely different set of trump attributions, which work really, really well. So, for example, the middle pillar in Bill's system is you start in Malkuth in the earth, then you have the moon, the path and the moon trump leading to the Yesod, the moon. Then the next trump you have is the sun, leading to the sun. Then the next trump you have is the star, isn't it, leading up to the Keter. So you have the moon, so you have the kind of a pathway leading moon, sun and stars. On either side of Malkuth, you have the fool is actually between Hod and Malkuth. And the world is between Netzach and Malkuth. If you go up the left-hand pillar, I can't remember which way around. You've got death and the devil. Which one is the hot path? Hot together.
The devil.
That's the devil, and then you have the devil, and then death. Mm-hmm. See, what's the other side?
Emperor.
Oh, that's right. The emperor and emperor. So the other side of the tree has the emperor and the empress. And the side paths, you have the is it the Wheel of Fortune? Thank you very much. very handy. Great. So then you have the paths that, if you like, join the sides of the tree. Wheel of Fortune, Justice, and the Last Judgment.
Is that coming across?
Coming across, yeah.
Going up.
Yeah. From Yesod, so Yesod to Hod is the magician card. Yesod to Netzach is the High Priestess card.
Say that again.
Yesod to Netzach is the High Priestess. Hod to Tiferet is the Chariot. Netzach to Tiferet is the Lovers. Tiferet to Geburah is the Tower. Tiferet to Gedula is Strength. Tiferet to Bina is the Hanged Man. Tiferet to Chokmah is temperance. And Bina to Keter is the hermit. And Chokmah to Keter is the Hierophant. Thank you very much. Hierophant. Well, they all make sense. That's the point. That's the point, right? They all make sense. You can take any one of the trumps, apply them to any one of the paths of the tree. So the point is not to discover, and people do, there are all kinds of fights about what's the true attribution. So no such thing as a true attribution. You play around with them. So I very loosely, in that visualization, there was a very loose relationship between the paths and the tarot trumps. And I, you know, wasn't doing it consciously. They were just arriving. You know, the journey really was from Malkut to Keter and then back down to here. It's the presence of the fool brings us back into relationship with everything.
It was amazing.
One other thing, yeah, particularly as we're sort of coming to the end of this course, the whole thing about, you know, you could revisit any of the paths that we've worked on, but you can also play around with it. You know, so meditate on a path, just pick a random trump. You know, so looking at, you know, so here we are looking at Keter to Chokmah. Let's say we had the Wheel of Fortune on that path. If we contemplate instead of the Fool, we reach using the Wheel of Fortune to enter into that path. Just do it for a moment. Just imagine yourself between Keter and Chokmah, between the deep awareness and that non-dual will, and visualize for a moment the spinning wheel of the Wheel of Fortune, and see what that shows you about the nature of this path. Now just bring your attention back out. What does it show you?
It showed me the machinery of the universe coming into being.
Yeah.
The wheels starting to turn.
Turn, yeah, that's one. Yeah.
The continual flow of all things.
Yeah.
They're coming from stillness. All that's implied by movement.
Mm-hmm.
Every implication you can have is the movement starts.
Okay.
It eventually devolves down to
nothing. There's many paths, many choices, and which do you tune in to take? And
mm-hmm.
Could you use that to go on the journey to see options of
different
ways?
Okay, good. Okay, so again, just close your eyes. Now we're going to take another trump. We're going to look at the trump of fortitude, the woman holding the lion.
Strength.
So just see what the strength trump, what the woman and the lion show you about the nature of this path. And bring your attention out. What does it show you this time?
Something about trust.
Mm-hmm.
She tempers the wildness, but not quite tempers, but helps it flow again.
Okay, yeah.
Mitigation.
She heals reactivity, yeah. And realigns the line.
Okay.
And she hints at the duality that's going to come into form,
yep.
But also asserts the harmony within that.
Okay, good. Great. Now I'm just going to get you to look at another path. We're going to use the same tarot card, the Strength tarot card. So I want you to now just close your eyes. I want you to consider the path between Yesod and Malchut. So just feel in for a moment that sense of the earth and that sense of the fluidity of Yesod, the inner moon. So between the moon and the earth, then consider the Strength trump. What does it show you about this path and this relationship between Yesod and Malchut? And just bring your attention out. What does it show? What is it? What do you get? What do you see this time on this different path?
For me, she brings a fire of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do other people see?
I think the descent of the angel. That softens the sort of the animal side of the nature, if you like.
Yeah. That softens that reactivity. Good. So you can see how it operates at different levels, right? So you can see that tramp operating between Keter and Hokmah gives us one element. If we place it on a different part of the tree, it illuminates it. It's because these are living archetypes, multidimensional living archetypes. And as we place them in different places of the tree, they reveal different qualities, different sides of themselves. They highlight different sides of the particular path that we're looking at. So in a way, that's one of the great things about the tree and the tower worked within this way, is these are very fluid, creative kind of forms. And the problem is that once you start getting them fixed in, well, what is the right way and fitting? And the thing that's the worst about Kabbalistic teachings is that because you are working with form. Okay, so we're creatively working with form, creating with ideas, images. Our own creativity, our own imaginations, and our minds and body, hearts and bodies. Now, the problem, so that gives us a lot of potential, a lot to work with. But the part of us that wants to feel secure and wants to know can use this to create a massive prison. And there are long, massive books written about Kabbalah that just squeeze all the life out of it because they add all these symbols together. So you'll be told you have to learn all these symbols, right? So you have to, in order to work with Kabbalah, you have to really kind of learn the tree and understand it and contemplate it and so that you've learned it all properly and you mustn't make mistakes. And so they'll get you to do visualizations where every bit of the path has to be in accordance with what it should be. So it has to have the right smell, the right colour, the right images, the right kind of animals must appear. And in a sense, you try to do that. You develop your memory, perhaps, and you develop your concentration, but actually your capacity to reach into inner experience is completely eroded by that way of doing it. It's much more playful, fluid. So it is this energy of the fool that we're looking at, this kind of light, interested, creative, being curious about things. And playing with the tree, playing with the trumps.
And deconstructing the last 3 years of work. Throwing it all in the air.
You start again, don't you? So this is just like.
Well, the deeper level really is the way in which you've internalized the pattern of the tree. Right, so not by cognitively knowing it. It's by the almost the felt sense of it somewhere. And then, because you then have internalized it, you can relax. You can allow yourself to play a bit. Now, normally, you know, for me, for example, because I've always worked for a lot, I can do all kinds of things with the tree and the tower. But the one I began with, which is the pattern we've used, is the one I naturally gravitate towards. Because it's the one I learned first, and I've mostly worked on it, and I've worked with Bill's tree quite a lot because I really like that, and I've done all kinds of random things with it. So when we come to teach this, I teach the one I most deeply know, of course. You know, not because it's better than Bill's or anybody else's, but it's just the one that I know best. And in a certain sense, I think that's as if you continue to work with these forms, you might work out of form for yourself, you know, and that's great. You know, so you find something that works for you, and then you can play with other formulations.
I guess it keeps it alive, so that's how you can study it for so long.
Yeah, it's a living form, completely that.
It's still an icon.
Yes, that's it. It's that simple thing, is about not letting it turn into an idol. So it becomes an icon because it's alive, it's moving, it's fluid. And it grows with you. It continues to grow with you.
And the Sephirots stay constant through these different models.
Yeah.
So the actual structure of the tree remains, even though the pathways.
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, so basically, if you like, what you have is a sense of the. Although, of course, your sense of the Sephirot change over time, but that's just like the underneath skeleton somewhere, and then within which then all kinds of possible sort of interactions, and of course you have people who will fight about the nature of the tree as well, and kind of what does one suffer. I've said this before, I always think when I start thinking about this aspect of, you know, people quarrelling about what's the right attribution, I was always reminded of the British Tortoise Society. The British Tortoise Society.
Tortoise
Society, yeah. You would think that would be a really gentle, beautiful cover. I've got a friend who used to run the British Tortoise Society. And he used to run Tortoise Rescue Centre. It's kind of full of hundreds of tortoise, beautiful creatures. So you would think this would be a gentle human activity. You know, kind of who... it's a hell realm of plot and counterplotting and people... arguing about the nature of the tortoise, the nature of breeds, the nature. So, you know, it's human nature to, if you like, to decide that something is right and something is wrong, and then to fight about it. And so that's absolutely true about the Tree of Life. People will very much decide this is right and this is the right way to do it, and everybody else is wrong, or... And all kinds of variations of that. And also, I suppose, the tendency of the mind to complicate things. Because the key thing really with the Tree of Life is simplicity. So what the roots of the Tree of Life really are, this idea of the idea of this tree in the garden that is both the image of the universe and the image of the human being. And the whole idea of the Sephirot is you stand on the earth, you look at the planets. You stand on the earth, you look at the moon, Mercury, Venus, you look at the sun, you look at Mars and Jupiter, Saturn, the sphere of what they then call the fixed stars, and then the source of all, the first movement. So it's that simplicity. That's where it all kind of comes from.
Somebody just left the shag and a cormorant view. Someone just left the Norfolk Wildlife Trust board, but we ran into an argument over whether shag was a cormorant or a cormorant.
Cormorant was shag. that's exactly the sort of thing. So I'm just going to read you a little bit more of Ibn Jabirul's poem, because this really shows where the roots of the Tree of Life come from. Now, yesterday we were looking at he's addressing the oneness, he's addressing Keter, and then he starts to, and then he describes the divinity as this fountain that brings everything. So then he starts to talk about in part two of the poem, the image of the universe. Who could put words to your power, splitting the globe of earth in your making, half of it land and the other water? The wheel of the wind you established over the sea, where it circles in circuits, as the wheel of it rests in that circle. And over the wind you established the sphere of fire. These foundations are four, though sharing a single foundation, source and font, from which they emerge renewed, and then through a fourfold font or spring diverge. So that's Malkut. This is it's describing the world that we're in with the four elements. It's the four suits of the tarot. He then says, who can speak of your wonders surrounding the sphere of fire, with a sphere of sky where the moon draws from the shine of the sun and glows. Across its path of circumference, it orbits in 29 days and a half. Its secrets profound and simple, its mass a mere 39th of the Earth's. And yet in the world it ushers in action, month by month in its annals, its phases of grace and misfortune. With the will of the Lord who formed it to signal the world of his glory and splendor. So suddenly then he brings in the quality of Yesod, the moon. And he goes on about the moon, and then he moves on from that to say, who could tell of your righteousness in surrounding the lunar heavens with a second sphere, perfectly sealed, within which is fixed the star that we called Mercury. 1/1000th of the earth in proportion, and brisk in its 10-day journey. It brings about strife and contention, bitter complaint and enmity. It lends one's weakness strength to accumulate riches and power, to amass great wealth and fortune. In the Lord's appointing it over his being, like a slave to watch over his master. This is the star of wisdom and brightness, endowing the simple with prudence, and the young with discernment and mind. And then, that's Mercury, Hod. Who could fathom your mysteries in surrounding the second sphere with the glowing circle of Venus, like a queen overlooking her armies, like a bride adorned with her jewels? In 11 months' time, she traces her compass, 1/37th of the earth in its mass, as its mysteries initiates know. With the Lord's will in the world, she renews quiet and all tranquility, gladness and winning gaiety, song and wordless melody, and the wedding canopy's joy and spell. She ripens the fruit of the land and its sweet, the choice fruit made sweet by the sun, and the fruit brought forth by the moon. Who could explain your secret in surrounding the circle of Venus with a fourth sphere of the Sun? It runs its course in exactly a year, surpassing the Earth in volume by 17,000, I don't know how you got these numbers, 17,000 hundreds, as scholars have made quite clear. It sends light to the firmament and stars. It sends out salvation, majesty and fear, with wonder renewing the world, with peace on occasion and often with war, bringing great kingdoms down, raising up others from ruins, its power establishing rise and decline, endowed by the Lord who formed it in perfect mind. Day by day it worships its king. Along its paths at the crossroads lifts its head with morning, then westward burns to dusk. With night it departs, and at dawn again it returns. Who really knows the wondrous acts in surrounding the sphere of the Sun with a fifth sphere, where reddish Mars rests like a king in his palace? Its orbit in 18 months being drawn, its mass like Earth but larger, by 1.5 of half of 1/4. It resembles the fiercest warrior, the shield of its powerful soldiers made red. It brings about battle and loss and slaughter, and men levelled by fire and blade. Their lifeblood soon dried out, their fat given over to flames, through years of scorching heat and drought and thunder and stone-sized hail. Those run through with swords and their slayers, who alone race towards evil and hurry to shed men's blood. Who could decipher the awe you inspire in surrounding the sphere of Mars with a sixth of tremendous size, within which Jupiter hovers, greater than Earth by 75 times? In 12 years it travels its cycle, the star of will and desire, arousing fear of the name, uprightness, and also repentance, and traits of excellent temper. It yields the harvest of fields, brings war and contention and strife to an end. Under its aspect all breaches are sealed. Who could expound your greatness in surrounding Jupiter's path with the seventh sphere of Saturn, which moves along in its circuit, more massive than the Earth by 99 times in its volume? In 30 years it orbits its course, provoking battles and pillage, exile, capture and hunger. For this is its nature, it ravages lands and uproots kingdoms, all with the will of the one who appoints it to accomplish his action, strange as it is. Who could draw near your majesty in surrounding the circle of Saturn with an eighth sphere in its circuit? It bears the 12 constellations on the line of a band skillfully woven, all the stars of the upper heavens cast at the time of its casting. From the force of these stars, the force of every creature below them derives, with the will of the one who formed them and set them in patterns above us. He created each in its fashion, all of them called by name, appointing each to its burden and change. Who could expose the things you have hidden, encasing the circles of signs with a ninth sphere, to surround creation, circuits and creatures, to close them within its border? It drives the stars of the sky in its might into their westerly motion. Each day at dusk it bows in the west to its king and the rule of the kingdom. All creatures of the world are in it, like a mustard seed in the sea. Such is its measure. Its greatness in truth is nothing to the greatness of its king and creator. Its proportion and vast dimension beside him are nothing and voidness. So these are the, if you like, very early accounts before we have ever see the diagram of the tree of that image of the tree. That's why it's called, this poem is called Keter Malchut, so it's the whole span of the, so that's that image. This is the deep, if you like, image of the tree. Then acquires all kinds of other kinds of attributes kind of later, but that's the root image that we return to. The Ibn Jabir is very good, really, at just describing that kind of vision of the universe, and then it's the integration of that image within us That is the so this sense of the so this is the divine image of the created universe, and this is the image of the human being as the small universe, as the sort of like the parallel, the condensation really of the universe itself. So as we look at the tree, as we work on the tree, we're working simultaneously with our image of ourselves and our image of the universe. And increasingly, the point of doing this is to innate, is to bring our own sense of self into balance, because of the sense of the need, if you like, for this work, is we have created a out of the if you like wounding of early life, the experience of early life, we've created a composite image of self and the universe that is not in balance, that does not reflect things as they actually are, but is an image that we have learned to live inside, that we can bear to live in. So we have used our creativity, our ability to sub-create, in Tolkien's terms, to the place of us, to where we are, this image of the creation. We've used this to create a sense of self and sense of world that we can bear to live in, but also limits us and contains us and doesn't enable our enormity to manifest. And the whole sense of the fool is to turn all that upside down. So the fool says, no, you don't need to do that at all. Actually, let go of all of this. Dance with me. Be foolish. Let go. Give away all that you think you know. All you think you know, all that you think you are. And you will discover that you are vast beyond measure. You will discover that you are loved beyond all reason. So that's why that image of him with half-clothed, naked, open-chested, feathers in the hair, but with that kind of look, you know, that look you find in the Visconti Suora, is that kind of look of kindness, that look of love, that look of stepping into the world. I mean, the Visconti artist has really caught that kind of quality somewhere.
Can I ask you a practical question?
Yep.
About the thing? Well, it seems to me that you, what you haven't emphasised is the position of the sephirot in the body, and the only time when you sort of do that is with the Kabbalistic cross.
Yeah.
But I find it immensely helpful to practice, because it's a lying down exercise, you know, to actually place the whole tree within my body.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
And then I know, I just find it really balancing. I also notice, particularly when I go to sleep, I sleep in a certain position, but when I'm wakeful, I habitually lie in the position of the hanged man,
mm-hmm.
which is just something to occupy your mind with when you've got insomnia, you know. And an invitation to see things upside down. So I just think if you put the paths, particularly, then you've got these tarot trumps all around you. Maybe that helps with the balancing, rather than concentrating on that imbalance as your faults and what you need to improve, sort of thing. But just working with the card you feel most in harmony with, or whatever.
I mean, that could work. I think in my own experience of embodying the tree, it's a complicated area, this, because actually the if you just get a felt sense of the tree, so that sense of, if you like, the Tiferet at the heart, Yesod at the pelvis, Dehat at the throat, Keter above the head, Malkut below, and then your Gebura right shoulder, Gedula left shoulder, Hod and Netzach as the two hips and legs. Now the felt sense of that does work very well for me, at least, and I think I can really see where that, you know, that can be a very good practice. If you start getting the paths involved in that, mm-hmm. I think it can get very complicated. if you try then to connect the, if you imagine the path of, I don't know, the, if you imagine your left leg, your left leg being the moon, or your right leg being judgment, now that might work as a cognitive exercise. It doesn't really work for me as a felt sense experience. But we're all different. I mean, it could work if it works for you, it does. But the real thing that over the years I've found that's important with a tree is to keep the exercises as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. So the I haven't done fully embodied the tree. I mainly tend to concentrate on the middle pillar and on the side, and using the Kabbalistic cross, because that brings in that principle of bringing opposites together, and the middle pillar generally is this great stabilizing kind of energy. And you can do exercises where you visualize the whole of the tree and then do the circulation including the whole of the tree. I always just found that a bit too complicated and a bit and left me in too cognitive a space, which is why I don't do it. But there's no reason why anybody, you know, somebody shouldn't try that out and see if that works for you.
When all the lower cards, if I can call them that, you know, congregated at Tiferet, you know,
yeah.
And you brought the whole of the tarot into that meditation. It was,
yeah, really, well, but the thing that's interesting about that, I didn't bring there were lots of trumps I didn't bring in.
Yeah.
So there was a spontaneous gathering. So the thing about that, so if I had tried to bring all the trumps in, it would have derailed the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I'd have had to try and do that consciously, and what I was doing was just noticing what turned up at that point. I mean, obviously there was a rough, you know, the structure was the middle pillar, so we enter into the, but even that in a slightly kind of, not quite as we normally would do it, you know. So so if I had been trying to bring all the trumps, it would have frozen everything completely. It wouldn't have worked. You know, it was much more, okay, let's hold this intention, let's see who turns up. Mm. And, you know, in some of the early Italian packs as well, you've got loads of different trumps. For example, you've got the Tarici de Martinio, which I've got here, which you can have a look at later on. So, but you have the primal cause, the octaversa, you have Jupiter, you have the Sun, you have Mercurio, you have a whole load of trumps. You have the trump of geometry, trump of logic, of the figure of Apollo. So they created all, you know, so they created all kinds of images and ideas. As well as, and you've got, you know, you've got justice, but you've also got charity, you've got strength, or you've got prudence, you've got temperance, you've got the senses, you've got philosophy. So what you find in this Renaissance period is they create lots and lots of images. But the one that stands the test of time really is the tarot as we know it, because it's somewhere, there's enough trumps in there for it to be manageable, but also enough for there to be enough diversity. And in a way, playing with the tree, like I've just described, really is what you do. Having learned it, you work, you play with it, you experiment with it, you try things out. You let it be part of your own creativity. So we've got about